Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today on this, the 60th anniversary of JFK's assassination, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the programme Jacob Hornberger, who kindly joined us earlier this year to talk about John F. Kennedy's war with the US national security state, which was a conversation about some of the historical and political circumstances in the US and beyond leading up to that tragic day of the 22nd of November 1963. And for those of you who didn't listen to that conversation, highly recommend that. That was TMR number 298 with Jacob Hornberger. Jacob Hornberger is founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation in the US. He has degrees in economics and law and had a career as a trial attorney for many years before going full-time into the educational foundation world. He has written and spoken extensively on the JFK assassination, authoring books such as An Encounter with Evil, The Abraham Zapruder Story, The Kennedy Autopsy, The Kennedy Autopsy 2, and Regime Change, The JFK Assassination. His foundation also publishes books by other researchers and has held JFK conferences with high-profile speakers such as Oliver Stone, Ron Paul, Jeffrey Sachs, Douglas Horne, Michael J. Glennon, Jefferson Morley, and others indeed. Jacob, thanks very much for coming back on the program.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Julian. Thank you for having me again.
It's great to be speaking with you. Enjoyed it enormously last time, and I'm anticipating another wonderful conversation today. Now, last time, as I said, we were discussing some of that background to JFK's assassination, but today we're going to be chatting about JFK's quote-unquote autopsy, which, of course, is the subject of a couple of your books, and I'm putting that word in inverted commas, as we say, this side of the pond, because there continues to be considerable, controversy, to say the least, swirling around that examination, or whatever it was, or was it even one event? These are questions straight away. What exactly are we talking about here? What did go on with JFK's body after the assassination? And why isn't this just a straightforward question here? I mean, surely it should be. If everything we've been told over the years is correct, you know, a lone nut with a rifle, a commission getting to the heart of the crime, then surely anomalies should be easily answered. But not so. And you make that clear in your book, The Kennedy Autopsy, which I have to say, and you haven't asked me to say this, I'm saying this off my own bat here, I have to say it's a very helpful book and an essential companion to Douglas Horne's magnum opus that we talked about last time, Inside the Assassination Records Review Board. So it helped me and will help any reader to navigate that amazing set of documents. So I highly recommend people to get a copy of that book. So in considering this autopsy narrative, let's begin with what happened to JFK immediately after the shooting, which takes us straight to Elm Street and that quick drive to Parkland Hospital to try to save the president's life. And straight away, we've got some strange events going on. So where should we start? Do you want to start with Dr. Earl Rose? Do you want to start before that with Roy Kellerman in the limousine? Where would you like to start, Jacob?
Well, let's start with what happened at the hospital, and then we can incorporate Roy Kellerman in that story.
Yeah.
Immediately after the shooting, the limousine driver, Greer, Secret Service guy, he starts driving to Parkland Hospital, and they're there with just a few minutes. Mm. And they take President Kennedy's, they take him into the hospital, try to save his life. It's a futile effort. And he expires about 25 minutes later at about 1 p.m. Central Time. With that moment, a team of Secret Service agents immediately goes into action, and it's headed by this man named Roy Kellerman. And Kellerman announces that he is operating under orders, his team. He's got a Thompson submachine gun, and that they're going to take President Kennedy's body back to Washington. Dr. Earl Rose is the Dallas County medical examiner. And he places himself in front of this huge ornate casket that has been purchased from a Dallas funeral home and brought over. And he announces that he's not going to permit this because he has to do an autopsy. And the reason he has to do an autopsy is that Texas state law requires this. This was a murder case under Texas law. At that time, it was not a federal offense to assassinate a president. So the federal government, Secret Service, did not have jurisdiction, any jurisdiction at all over this crime. This was just a straight murder case under Texas state law, which requires an autopsy. Mm. Well, at this point, Kellerman starts screaming and yelling, issuing profanities, ordering Rose to get out of the way. He says, this is the president of the United States, and we're taking this body back to Washington. And Rose stood his ground. And at that point, the other Secret Service agents that were there pulled their coats back to brandish their guns. And one of the obviously larger ones in this Secret Service team picks up Rose physically and carts him over to a wall and wags his finger in his face as if saying, no, no, no. So they forced their way out of Parkland Hospital. Now, I should mention that Kellerman was in the limousine in which President Kennedy was riding. He was in the passenger seat next to Greer. And so they take the body in the big, huge Dallas ornate casket. They put it in the back of a vehicle there from the funeral home, and they take it over to Dallas Love Field, where the vice president, who is now the president, Lyndon Johnson, is waiting for it. Mm. He's already had seats removed from the back of Air Force One, which he had now taken over. The Air Force Two was his plane, and it was still there. So it's clear, as I argue in my books, that it had to be Johnson that issued that order to get that body out of there, because he's the guy that was having the seats removed and waiting for this casket.
Yeah, could we?
And so that's part one of what happened here.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to come back to LBJ in just a minute. Can I just ask you something a little bit more about the Secret Serviceman Kellerman? So you say he was in the limousine. So his job was to protect the president in the case of a shooting like this. But am I right that there is a shot initially and then Kellerman just doesn't do anything? Then there is the fatal shot. So this is suspicious to start with, isn't it?
It's extremely suspicious. And it brings up other things. You see, the job of a Secret Service agent is to save the life of a president, to prevent an assassination. That's their primary duty. And every one of them knows that they are risking their lives here. If they can't take that chance, then they shouldn't take the job. So it's the job of a Secret Service agent, if a shot rings out, to immediately cover the body of the president with his body. Hmm. His job is to take any shots that are intended for the president. And in fact, that's what one of the Secret Service agents that came up from behind that was crawling on the back of the car, he was trying to do. Hmm. He was trying to cover the president with his body, but he was too late.
Right. That was Clint Hill. Was that Clint Hill?
That was Clint Hill. Yeah. Hmm. And so you've got Kellerman sitting there when the first shot rings out, that apparently, by all accounts, is the shot that hits Kennedy in the neck. And it was not necessarily a fatal wound. And so Kellerman's job at that point was to immediately jump over the seat and cover the president's body. And instead, he just sits there like a bumping log, does nothing, just looking at the president. Now, in my most recent book, An Encounter with Evil, the Abraham Zapruder story, I know this isn't the theme of this particular show, but I think it's important to bring out that the theme of that book is that the CIA, on the very weekend of the assassination, produced an altered fraudulent copy of the Zapruder film. They commandeered secretly the original film. And as I detail in that book, they shipped it over to Rochester, New York, to a top secret film facility that was the equivalent of Hollywood. And the reason they did that is because there were like 59 witnesses that said that the car made a complete stop or a near stop, which then enabled the shooters to hit Kennedy in the head, the fatal headshot. That's no longer in the extant Zapruder film. So you've got Greer over here stopping the car. You've got Kellerman over there just staring at the president until the fatal shot hits him in the head. You add this up and it's pretty clear, especially once we get to Bethesda National Medical Center, where the military conducted the autopsy, that Kellerman was part of what was going on here. And so was Greer.
So Kellerman was the guy who was saying, look, we're taking this body. You're not doing the normal procedure here. We're taking this. It's a military matter, basically, and it's under our control. Yeah, I mean, some people might think, well, this is a bit fanciful talking about the Zapruder film, and I'd love to have a chat with you about that sometime. And indeed, I saw an interview with, I think it was Doug Horn was speaking to a guy called Dino Bruglioni, who was in charge of developing the Zapruder film. And it seems that there was another set of another crew developing the film that was unknown to him. And I have to say that that's all extremely suspicious. And I'd love to talk about that. And Dino Brilioni seemed to me to be an incredibly credible individual in that conversation. Can I just go back to William Greer? So this is the other chap who was in the limousine. Is he the same chap who earlier in this motorcade, there's video of him throwing his hands up in the air as if he's trying to do his job, and he's being told something like, no, things are not as usual. He just throws his hands up in the air and he doesn't know what's going on. And I understand that there was to be laxer security than usual. The story goes that Kennedy supposedly said he didn't want the normal security. You know, whether Kennedy said that, I don't know, but this is what I've heard. But there certainly is that video of some security person throwing their hands up in the air. They don't know what's going on. Have you come across any of that?
Yeah, there's a video online of that, and that actually took place at Dallas Love Field when Kennedy and Mrs. Kennedy land there from Fort Worth. They had spent the night in Fort Worth. They'd given a breakfast talk there, and then they flew over to Dallas Love Field, which was like, I don't know, a 20-minute flight. That wasn't Greer, though, because the standard policy was to have these Secret Service agents standing on the footboard of the limousine, kind of serve as a guard against somebody trying to assassinate. The allegation is that this is what the Secret Service said, is that Kennedy said, I don't need those. And it's virtually impossible that Kennedy would have said that, because the standard procedure, Kennedy's mindset was always to defer to the Secret Service. Whatever they said, that was fine with him. They were in charge. So you've got this film where this guy is going over there to apparently get onto the limousine, which was standard procedure, and he's being waved off. He's being told, don't do that. And that's why he throws up his hands like, what the heck is going on? I'm supposed to be doing this. But Greer is driving the limousine, so it couldn't have been Greer. It was just some guy that's not part of what's going on here raising his hands and saying, hey, I don't understand. Why are we getting called off here? And you're right about the lax security. What they should have done was go into all these buildings and close the windows in these skyscrapers there and seal the windows and then keep eyes out on the windows so that if somebody opens a window, you can immediately radio to stop the motorcade and get up there and investigate why somebody's opening the window. But they didn't do any of that. Dealey Plaza was actually the perfect place for an ambush. It was at the end of the parade route. Relatively few people were there compared to the downtown streets. So that ensured that there weren't going to be a lot of photographs and movie video being taken, film of the assassination. They moved the press car way back in the motorcade when ordinarily it would be in front of the presidential vehicle so that they could be filming the president as he's greeting the crowds and waving at the crowds. This time, interestingly enough, they put the press car several cars back so that that ensured that you didn't have any professional photographs or professional film being taken of the assassination. So when you add all this up, there's a lot of nefarious aspects to what was going on there in Dealey Plaza.
Yes, indeed. I like that. When you add all this up, the sort of cumulative suspicions are very powerful indeed. Come on, let's go back to Lyndon B. Johnson. So you say that it looks, in your view, and it looks as if he was giving orders to Kellerman with regard to getting hold of the body, making sure that the local coroner didn't deal with the autopsy. Give us more about why you think Johnson at least knew what was going on with this.
Well, Johnson's role in this is very revealing because, for one, it's clear when Kellerman says, I'm operating under orders. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing. You would expect the Secret Service to cooperate with local law enforcement, local officials, because there's going to be a criminal prosecution, presumably. And ordinarily, you would expect law enforcement personnel, federal and state, to work together to make sure that they get the malefactor, the assassin, convicted. And so for a federal official to say, you're not going to do your job. Now, keep in mind that an autopsy is critically important evidence in most murder cases. You're going to call the pathologist to the stand. The prosecutor is. He's going to ask him, did you determine the cause of death? You have to keep records of everything you did. You have to keep the chain of custody of everything. You have to do everything meticulous because you're going to have a team of high-powered criminal defense lawyers challenging you every step of the way. So this is an extraordinary thing when Kellerman says, we're not going to let you do your job. We're taking this body. And Rose says, you can't lose the chain of custody on the body. You have to do this thing here. And that term chain of custody is a legal term. And Kellerman says, I'm taking this body away. Well, Johnson, after the president is hit in Dealey Plaza, Johnson goes to the hospital. He's in a separate car, but he goes to the hospital and waits there for about 25, 30 minutes until President Kennedy is declared dead. And while he's there, he makes a very interesting and very revealing declaration. He says to somebody, you know, this could be the first stage in a nuclear attack on the United States by the Soviet Union. Mm. Now, keep in mind that this is about 1 year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the world came to the very precipice of all-out nuclear war. Mm. So he's conjuring this up. And it's not a totally out-of-space thing. I mean, it's a reasonable declaration for him to make. This could be the first stage.
So you say he's conjuring this up, but how do we know he's doing that? Could it not be that he received, let's say, a communication from military intelligence to say, look, we think maybe the Soviets are responsible for this. This is a possibility. Look, the whole thing now needs to become a military matter. Let's take custody of the body for national security.
It would have been too quick for that to happen. I mean, we're talking about just 20, 25 minutes. They're sitting at Parkland waiting for the president to die. But let's defer to Johnson and assume that he's making this declaration in good faith, because it is a reasonable thing to assume that, hey, this could be the Soviets attacking us. Mm-hmm. So he gets in the car as soon as Kennedy's declared dead. He gets in a car to take him to Dallas Love Field. On the way, he repeats this concern and he scrunches down in the seat and he says, we could be coming under an ambush here. This could be the Soviets that are going to attack the United States. And so the idea, of course, is that you knock out the president, you knock out the vice president, and then who's going to be having the black bag to respond with nuclear weapons? Right. So he's again expressing this concern, Julian, on the way to Dallas Love Field. However, when he gets to Dallas Love Field, everything changes. And this is why it's so revealing, his criminal participation and what was going on here. He gets to Dallas Love Field, and all of a sudden, there's no more concern. He's waiting for the body to come. He's having seats removed. He decides that he needs to be sworn in, which is buying him more time. He calls the attorney general, Bobby Kennedy, the deceased president's brother, and says, do I need to be sworn in? And Bobby says, no, you're automatically the president. But he says, well, no, I'm going to do this. And he later denies that Kennedy told him that. But he's over there lollygagging for, I don't know, an hour and 45 minutes or so, and then he takes off. Now, I ask you, if a man even has a 1% mentality that there's a chance of a nuclear attack here, he is going to get up in the air immediately. He's not going to lollygag. He's not going to wait for the body. He's not going to get sworn in. His job is to defend America. And if there's nuclear bombs coming in, they're coming in on Dallas, because clearly the Soviets would know that both the president and the vice president were in Dallas. Instead, he just takes his sweet time there. Now, why is that so important? Well, it shows that his expressions of concerns were false when he said this could be the first stage of a nuclear attack. Because if he really believed that, he would have gotten up in the air immediately. What he's doing is he's conjuring up, and this was one of his roles. He was conjuring up the prospect of a nuclear attack on the United States. And as we go further and we see what was going on at Bethesda and in the aftermath of Bethesda, where the autopsy was taking place, we see that this was a critically important thing in the cover-up of the assassination, conjuring up what every American feared the most, and that was the possibility of nuclear war.
It is very strange, suspicious behavior. And other things are strange about this as well. So why do we have any explanation as to why he wanted the luggage removed from his normal plane, so Air Force Two, onto Air Force One? Do we have any explanation as to why is he behaving in this way?
Well, his job clearly in this thing was to get the body out of Dallas and put it in the hands of the military. And your point about the luggage is very interesting, you see, because his plane was Air Force Two. As the vice president. And Air Force Two was a duplicate of Air Force One. It had all the same equipment. Air Force One, that was Mrs. Kennedy's plane, along with the president, of course. he should have just gotten into Air Force Two and taken off. That to me would have been the prudent thing if everything was normal. Let's get up in the air. Let's head on back to Washington or to some secret location and then leave Air Force One there for Miss Kennedy to return to Washington with Secret Service agents and so forth. Instead, he takes over, he commandeers Air Force One. And he's actually lying in the bedroom when Mrs. Kennedy, who's got her blood-soaked suit on, walks in. Yeah. And there's this guy, just lying on her bed. I mean, it was a kind of an uncomfortable deal. He excuses himself and lets her have her room. But then he says, I'm going to have the luggage. He orders the luggage to be moved from Air Force Two to Air Force One, which was ridiculous because both planes were returning to the same place. So what I contend he was doing was just buying time until that body arrived. And it's clear he's waiting for the body because he's ordered seats to be removed from the back of Air Force One to make room for the casket.
Okay. Now, we have the strange story that will build up by what we will say in a few minutes from now, that very possibly Kennedy's body was removed from the ornate casket that arrived on Air Force One and transferred to somewhere else. I don't know whether you think it could have been Air Force Two or a helicopter or something. Perhaps you'll tell me that in a minute. But suspicions arise about this because of seemingly multiple times the body arriving at Bethesda. You'd expect it to arrive once, which obviously it did, but it looks as if we have different arrivals, which is very, very strange. Could you tell us about why there is this suspicion that there's more than one arrival of a casket at Bethesda?
Yeah. Keep in mind first, though, that when Air Force One lands at Andrews Air Force Base, Johnson's plane, Air Force One, with the big, heavy, funeral-like Dallas casket, Johnson delivers this casket, or the casket is taken off the plane and put into a navy gray ambulance with the purpose of taking the body to Bethesda National Naval Medical Center, which is a military facility. Now, what's fascinating to me about this is that all of this is considered normal. I mean, if you look at the mainstream press back then and even today, everybody just considers this to be a normal thing. Well, it's not a normal thing. The federal government had no jurisdiction over this crime whatsoever, and much less the military. But by this time in America, the military had a sacrosanct role in American life. This was the height of the Cold War. So the national security establishment, which includes the CIA and the Pentagon, the vast military establishment, were playing central roles in American life. So nobody questions this. I mean, it really is extraordinary. What business does the military have conducting an autopsy on a crime that's committed in Texas? There was pathologists there in Maryland, in Washington, D.C., in Virginia. In fact, probably they have the best pathologists in the country per population. But Johnson doesn't call one of these pathologists and says, hey, I've got the president's body. No, he delivers it into the hands of the military. So the Dallas casket is then placed in the back of this limousine, and it starts proceeding with Mrs. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Roy Kellerman, who we've already been discussing. Oh, it starts proceeding slowly over to the front of the Bethesda facility, which is about, about a 25-minute ride, 30-minute ride. But in the 1990s, you had an independent agency that operated under the president, being formed by Congress, called the Assassination Records Review Board. And it came into existence to enforce what was called the JFK Records Act. Mm-hmm. What happened was that Oliver Stone had come out with his movie JFK, which posited that the assassination was actually the result of a regime change operation on the part of the national security establishment and rejected the official lone nut theory of the assassination. And at the end of that movie, Stone had included a blurb that they were still keeping many of their assassination-related records secret, the Pentagon, the CIA, the Secret Service, the FBI. And there was such an outcry over this that public opinion pressured Congress into enacting the JFK Records Act, which mandated that these federal agencies had to release their records relating to the assassination. So the Assassination Records Review Board is brought into existence to enforce this. Well, the ARRB discovered the existence of a guy named Roger Boygen. And Boygen had been a Marine sergeant on the weekend of the assassination. His team was to provide security, make sure no unauthorized people came into where the autopsy was being conducted. And he told the ARRB that he had saved a copy of his after-action report that he had submitted to his superiors immediately after that weekend. And so he sent them a copy of it. And that report said, "We carried the president's body into the morgue at 6:35 p.m. Well, that creates immediate problems because the official story is that the president's body was brought into the morgue by an honor guard consisting of various members of the armed forces, headed by an army lieutenant named Sam Byrd, was brought in at 8 p.m. So now you have Byrd saying 8 p.m., which is the honor guard, and you've got Boygen saying, "We brought the body in at 6:35 p.m.
Although Boygen doesn't actually say it was the body, does he? He said that they bring in a casket.
They bring in the casket.
At 6:35. But he doesn't actually...
At 6:35 p.m.
Yes, at 6:35 p.m. But I believe from his after-action report, he doesn't actually say that he saw the president's body inside that particular casket. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. Mm. You're absolutely right. But there were other enlisted men that had come forward even prior to this, and they came forward before the ARRB, that corroborated the fact that the president's body was in this casket. And they said that what they did was they met a black hearse outside the morgue that had a shipping casket, not the big Dallas ornate heavy casket, but just like a regular shipping casket that one uses to transport bodies across the country. It was a common thing in the Vietnam War, which, of course, was going on at this time.
Absolutely. There's a guy called Dennis David. He said that exactly what you've just said there, you know, this is his quote, "A simple gray shipping casket, such as he frequently saw..." This is Horn, actually, reporting on what David said. "Such as he frequently saw used later during the Vietnam War." So an aluminium sort of cheap thing.
Yeah, it's just a lightweight shipping casket. Mm. And so here you have Dennis David that's saying, "We brought in the shipping casket." You have Roger Boygen saying the casket was brought in at 6:35 p.m. So you have they're corroborating each other. Mm. And then there were other enlisted men that were corroborating what Dennis David said. And then they were saying also that inside the morgue, when the casket was opened, the president's body was in a body bag, like a rubberized body bag. Well, in Dallas, the nurses did not put President Kennedy's body in a body bag before they put him in the big, heavy, ornate Dallas casket. They wrapped his body and his head with white sheets. So suddenly somebody has succeeded in putting the president's body in a body bag and in this shipping casket. Here you have two. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, indeed. As you say, there are a number of other people who talk about this as well. And in my researches around this, I found a documentary called The Fifth Estate, which I'll put links to in the show notes, of course. And there's a guy called Paul O'Connor, who I think was a Navy corpsman. He was a medical technician involved in the autopsy. He told, I believe it was the House Committee on Assassinations back in the 70s. He also told David Lifton, the researcher, that it was this cheap metal casket involving a zipper. Now, the exact quote, I think, is very important because he claims actually to have seen the president's body in the context of this cheap casket and this zipped bag. And this is one of the sort of missing links I was looking for because, you know, did they actually see the body? But he claims to. Let me quote exactly what he said here because I think it is important. Quote, he says, "It was a plain casket. And when I say plain, now this is overdubbed by the narrator, which is a bit irritating, but he continuously speaks and then you can hear his voice again. So he says, and when I say plain, there was nothing fancy about it as far as being bronze. It wasn't bronze. We opened the whole casket up. And there was a grey body bag, zip shut. We unzipped the body bag, and the president's body was lifted out of the body bag. It's completely naked except for a sheet wrapped around his head, a bloody sheet." And then he says, at some point, "We got the last part of the sheet off. There was a gasp in the room, and I looked down and I said to myself, my God, there's no brain. It's all gone." So he claims actually to have seen the president in the context of this cheap casket. Do you know whose team he was part of, as a matter of interest?
He's part of the autopsy team. I forget what exactly his title is, but he was one of the autopsy assistants. But I forget what he actually did, you know, in terms of assisting the pathologist during the autopsy.
Sure. No, the reason why I ask about...
But he was part of that team.
Sure. The reason why I ask that is because Dennis David talks about his team and Boyjian talks about his team. And the question could be, well, are these different teams? Or the most consilient thing to say is they're all the same team, but I just can't find that substantiated.
Well, I could be mistaken because there are many, many moving parts here.
And exactly.
Paul O'Connor, I think, was part of the autopsy team, but I'm not positive. He may have been part of the security teams.
Still.
But what we're dealing with here is at least two set. You got essentially three teams. You've got the team that is carrying the shipping casket in at 6:35 p.m., and that's important. Then you've got Sam Bird's team that's carrying the Dallas casket in with the president's body at 8 p.m., and then you've got the autopsy team of assistants to the pathologist.
Yeah, all very, very strange. Yeah, it cries out for, what's the answer to this? There's just one more thing that I would like to run by you that's odd about Roger Boyjian's report here, because he says that the members of his detail were posted at various places throughout the corridors and morgue entrances. And then he says the remainder of the night was relatively quiet, except for a few minor encounters with newsmen. So I find that odd, because if the casket came in at 8 o'clock, why is there no mention of that in his report? If he's got all these men standing on doors, making sure that nothing goes in or out without them seeing it, all they're reporting is, well, we had interaction with newsmen and that was it. That's a bit odd, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it could be that he was primarily reporting on what he participated in. I don't know. By the time the ARRB found him, he could not remember very much of what had happened and said, essentially deferred to his report. But there's virtually no question about the fact that Bird's team carried in the Dallas casket.
Right.
There's people on that team that were corroborating this. There's a guy named Hugh Clark that wrote a book called Betrayal, A JFK Honor Guard Speaks, where he detailed what had happened. And everybody understood that it was Bird's team that carried in. That was their job. That's what they were called, the Honor Guard. It was their job to carry the president's body into the morgue. And so the fact that it wasn't included in Boyjian's report, I think, is probably just because he wasn't part of that. That's the only thing I can assume.
Yeah.
That was Bird's job, and that was in Bird's report.
Yes, I suppose it could have been just taken as read that happened, but that wasn't part of his, it wasn't within his purview. That's possible. We have this business, just go on about the body bag, but there clearly was some sort of body bag involved with this, and some people call it clear plastic, other people say it's black, other people say it's grey, but there does seem to have been a body bag involved, and you wouldn't have assumed that to be in connection with the ornate casket, would you?
Well, no, it was clearly not part of the ornate casket situation, because the Dallas nurses established that they just wrapped the entire body in white sheets, put it into the casket, turned over the top. And so the body bag is something completely different. Now, let me point out that no one's ever been able to establish when this switch took place. But clearly, based on the evidence here, at somewhere along the way from Parkland, this body was taken out of the Dallas casket, just taken out and then later put in the shipping casket. That's the hunch. And it would have been logical for them to do this at Parkland Hospital, for example, when they first got there, or when Johnson was getting sworn in. And they would have had a perfect excuse to justify this, because the deputy sheriffs could have been rushing to Love Field right then to take control over the body, because, again, Texas law required this. So once they learned that what had happened to Earl Rose, so the idea would be, let's take the body out, throw it into this luggage storage area, and then if the sheriffs come up, we just give them the empty Dallas casket. They're not going to open it up. They're going to think the body's in there, and then they take off with the body. But nobody really knows this. But then when it gets to Bethesda, the idea is that this body is flown to the Bethesda morgue in a helicopter. And there were helicopters there that night.
Right.
And then placed in the shipping casket, put into the black hearse, which these enlisted men said was filled with men with suits. We don't know who those men with suits were.
Yeah.
Drives 2 or 3 minutes to the Bethesda morgue, where it's then offloaded at 6:35 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, we don't actually know what happened, but something must have happened to make that switch. Indeed. Can I just go? I've got to just include it as we're in this part of the conversation. There is another piece of evidence from a guy called John Van Herzen. Now, he was an embalmer, is that right, with Gawler's funeral home? There is a memo for Gawler's funeral home, which puts this in black and white. It says, name President Kennedy, place of death Dallas, address White House, sent by Colonel Miller, date 22nd of November 1963, autopsy, yes, Bethesda, morgue, conveyance, US Navy ambulance, embalmer John Van Herzen, remarks. Now, listen to these remarks. Body removed from metal shipping casket at USNH at Bethesda. Now, my question to you would be, would you write shipping casket if you'd removed the body from an ornate casket?
There's no possibility that you can confuse these two things. When we're talking about the Dallas casket, we're talking about the kind of casket that's used at funerals. Mm. Huge, heavy thing, ornate. It was their most expensive casket. Enormously huge and heavy. There's no way you could, that one, just a few people could pick this thing up. I mean, you needed like 6 or 7 people. It's that heavy. A shipping casket was very lightweight. That was why it was used for transporting things. And the memo that you refer to from the Gawler's funeral home is very, very important, because Gawler's funeral home was the most prestigious funeral home in Washington, D.C. at this time. Mrs. Kennedy had chosen them to conduct the funeral. So they were conducting the funeral, but they were also doing the embalming after the autopsy. And the ARRB discovers the existence of this memo. And the memo had been kept secret for 30 years, wow, along with Roger Boydgen's report. Keep in mind that the military was required to turn over to the ARRB all its assassination-related records. It did not turn over Boydgen's report. Still hasn't to this day. And the Gawler's funeral home memo had just stayed secret all this time. And I'm not really sure how the ARRB found it, but clearly the Gawler's representative who identified it was surprised that the ARRB had uncovered this thing. But there it is, shipping casket, body unloaded from the shipping casket, which is totally different, again, from the Dallas casket.
Yeah.
So more corroboration that the body was brought in early in the shipping casket,
yeah,
and then later introduced again in the Dallas casket. So we still have the problem of how do you get the body back into that Dallas casket so that it can then be brought in officially at 8 p.m. Now, how do we know it was brought in at 8 p.m.? Because that's Sam Bird's report. He had an after-action report that said, my team and I carry this thing in at 2000 hours, 8 p.m. So that's how we know that there's another introduction of the body into the morgue at 8 p.m., Sam Bird's report.
Yeah, wow. Obviously, this is a whistle-stop tour about all this information, and I'm wanting to move on now, of course, to what happened next. So we'll have to skim over things a little. And of course, people can read your book and indeed Doug Horne's book to get much more information about this. But it's good to have an introduction to these questions that are there. So you're talking about 8 p.m. Now, I understand that a guy called Colonel Fink, who was a forensic pathologist, got a phone call at 8 p.m. to say, look, we've got the president's body here at Bethesda. We need you to come and help with the autopsy, please. I believe he said this at the Clay Shores trial. So he got this phone call at 8 p.m. And he was told that they already had x-rays of JFK's head. Now, how is this? This doesn't make any sense to me. What's your explanation for this?
Well, it all fits in with what we're talking about.
Indeed.
So the two principal pathologists were James Humes and Boswell. I forget Boswell's first name. J. Thornton Boswell. That's what Boswell's first name was. So you got Humes and Boswell. They're Navy pathologists, but they're not forensics pathologists. They're just regular pathologists. So Humes decides to call Colonel Pierre Fink, Army, because he's a forensics pathologist. And he calls him at 8 p.m., and says, would you come and help us with the autopsy? And Fink says, yeah. Well, Fink, as you point out, testifies in a criminal prosecution in New Orleans in the late 1960s, as well as he points this out in a report that he gave, and it's called a Bloomberg report, to his commanding officer, that says, when I got this call at 8 p.m., I was told by Humes that they already had x-rays of the president's head. Well, if Sam Byrd's team, the honor guard, is bringing the body in at 8 p.m., which they did,
okay,
there's no question about that, how could they already have x-rays when the president's body is being brought in at the exact same time that Humes is calling Fink and saying, we have x-rays of the president's head?
Well, could it be that the x-rays were taken at Parkland?
No.
Have we got any evidence to suggest that?
No, because everybody agrees. Nobody disputes the fact that there were no x-rays whatsoever taken at Parkland. They were trying to save the president's life. They didn't have time to do x-rays.
No.
And the president died within 20, 25 minutes. So there would have been no point in doing x-rays after he's dead, of course. So there's no question that that's indisputable. Nobody's ever raised that as a possibility.
Okay.
So that means that's further corroborative evidence. In fact, it's almost dispositive corroborative evidence that the body was in there before Sam Byrd's team brought it into the Dallas casket, which means that the body was brought in at 6:35 p.m.
Right.
During that period of time, x-rays were taken of the president's head, which then enabled Humes to make this statement. Now, clearly, this is an admission against interest. I mean, this is very incriminating here.
Okay. All right. So that's the idea that you're saying something that you inadvertently say that goes against your best interests. And that is in itself very strong evidential criteria. That's right?
The law recognizes this in criminal cases, that when you make an admission against interest, it is powerful evidence because it's akin to a confession. It's not a real confession. You know, the law recognizes when you confess to a crime, that's pretty powerful evidence of guilt. An admission to against interest is akin to that.
Okay.
Because it's not in your interest to make this kind of declaration. So Hume screws up when he says we've already got x-rays because he's effectively admitting the body's already there before Sam Byrd's team brings it in at 8 p.m.
All right. So this is the business where it's so difficult to control all the information that's inside your head, and you let something slip and you don't realize what the future consequences will be of that when somebody's trying to piece together the narrative. So that's what's going on here.
Yeah. You know, when you're making up a story, there's a lot of moving parts if it's a complex story, and it's hard to keep it all straight. It's hard to keep it straight with other people. And you see, this is why I have long argued, Julian, and this was the power of Doug Horne's book. It's a 5-volume book called Inside the Assassination Records Review Board. Doug Horne served on the staff of the Assassination Records Review Board in the 1990s. He was the chief analyst for military records. And he ends up writing this 5-volume book based on his experience there, and primarily focusing on the autopsy. That I had read many books about the assassination, and I gradually became convinced that it was a regime change operation, but not beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the burden of proof in a criminal case. I practiced law as a criminal and civil trial attorney for 12 years. So that's the way I think. I don't think in terms of conspiracy theories. I think in terms of evidence. That's the way I was trained to think. And so as I read these books, I thought, okay, they gradually convinced me that this had happened, but not beyond a reasonable doubt. When I discovered Doug Horne's book, I crossed that line into beyond a reasonable doubt. Not because of what happened in Dealey Plaza, because I don't think anybody can prove that the military or the CIA assassinated Kennedy beyond a reasonable doubt in Dealey Plaza. But once Horne established beyond a reasonable doubt that there had been a fraudulent autopsy, shenanigans here, that's when it dawned on me that a fraudulent autopsy has no innocent explanation.
Right.
When they're sneaking the body in early, you know that they're up to no good here. And once that's established, then that's what establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that they orchestrated the assassination, because there's no innocent explanation for this. Who else would they be covering up for? Especially since Roy Kellerman effectively launches into motion this fraudulent autopsy immediately on the president's death. Because there's no way to explain Kellerman's actions at Parkland except that it was already pre-planned as to what was going to go on at Bethesda Morgue.
And I have to say that the strongest evidence for this, in my view, is with regard to the injury in the back of the president's head, which we'll get on to in just a moment. I just wanted to come back to Fink and the fact that he also testified to having been told about these x-rays. This was at the House Committee on Assassinations, House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s. So he was before a forensic pathology panel, I think it was 78. His quote, "I remember that on the phone, Dr. Humes told me he had good x-rays of the head. That I remember." Now my question here is, okay, he says he remembers that. There is a possibility that he doesn't remember that. It's a false memory. He's made a mistake there. Why couldn't we not say that it's not actually Humes letting something slip, but actually Fink just didn't remember it correctly?
Well, of course, that's always possible, but that's an important thing. And the fact that he repeats it, he repeated it in his Bloomberg report, which was submitted, I think, soon after the events here, when his memory would presumably be very sound. Mm. And then in New Orleans, he's under oath. One would be very careful about what he remembers and what he doesn't remember when he's testifying under oath. And so the fact that he states this at least twice. Now, you said that he also stated it before when he testified before the House Select Committee. I don't recall that.
I think so, yeah. I may have got that wrong. There's so much information here that I...
Well, it's possible.
But I think so.
It's possible. I always thought that he had done it twice, but it's very possible he did it three times. But even if he does it twice, that would indicate to me very persuasive evidence that this is not a memory lapse, that it actually happened that way. That
Humes I think it... Yeah, so sorry, I think it is just twice. I didn't intend to give the impression that it was three times.
To me, that's very powerful evidence, the fact that he would put it in a written report and that then he would testify under oath on it. So you know, anything's possible, but I would argue that that's very persuasive evidence that he did remember that and that it stuck with him.
Okay, so at the Clayshaw trial, I believe, and then at the House Select Committee on Assassinations, those two. I think that's right.
No, the Bloomberg report.
Oh, the Bloomberg report. Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. And I think it's worth mentioning also that when Fink did testify there at the Clay Shaw trial, I think it was in 68 or 69, that he was asked, why didn't you dissect the neck wound? Because that's standard procedure. You dissect a wound to see the bullet trajectory, see exactly where the bullet entered, where it came out. And Fink started hemming and hawing when the prosecutor was asking him about this neck wound. Why didn't you dissect it? And he was filibustering. But it was a sharp prosecutor. He was not going to get finagled by this guy. And so after he'd give this long-winded answer that didn't answer the question, the prosecutor just stuck with him and said, okay, that's all fine and good, but why didn't you dissect that neck wound? And Fink goes off into the song and dance again. And finally, the prosecutor turns to the judge and says, Your Honor, would you order him to answer the question directly? And the judge says, Colonel Fink, answer the question directly. And then it comes out. It's clear what he was trying to hide. He says, I was ordered not to touch the neck wound. Well, this is extraordinary, Julian. The pathologists are supposed to be in charge of the autopsy. And when the prosecutor asked him, who issued that order? He said, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Well, what are the chances that somebody's not going to remember an order of that nature? And so you know that what's so revealing about this is that somebody is managing this autopsy, somebody higher. Somebody's over there getting that black hearse to bring the shipping casket over. Somebody's managing the autopsy that is not the pathologist. They're there to take orders. That, to me, was a fascinating revelation when Fink was clearly trying to hide the fact that he had been ordered this. And then I think spoke falsely when he said he didn't remember who did it.
Yes, indeed. With Dr. Perry at Parkland, I believe we have evidence that he was told to change his testimony. So we do seem to have these shadowy figures in the background telling people they ought to say such and such and to change what they have said. And maybe we'll come to that in a bit. I want to come to this business about the back of the head, which I think, for me anyway, seems to be the strongest indication that things were messed about with on this day. So we have the large hole in the occipital region, that's the back of the head, a little towards the right, is what a lot of people said at Parkland, a lot of the professionals there and others. But as far as the official story has it, it's more towards the top and the right. So that doesn't really, that doesn't fit. Could you give us some idea of who the people are who said this, what kind of positions they had? Who are these people who give a different story?
Yeah, this is one of the most revealing aspects of what was going on here, that when Kennedy is hit in Dealey Plaza, the shot that many of us contend happened came in from the front. If there was at least one shot, there's evidence that may have been two shots that hit him in the head. But when a bullet enters a person's body, it enters with the size of the bullet. It's just a very small entry wound. Mm. But because it's pushing mass in front of it, it blows out the other side if it does exit. So Kennedy, according to the witnesses, and I'll detail those witnesses in a minute, had a huge blowout wound in the back of his head, like 2 inches diameter, 3 inches in diameter. It was just this huge, they described it as like an orange size hole.
In the back of the head.
In the back of the head, in what was called the occipital region of the head. Now, the occipital region is like if you're lying in a bathtub and you put your head, there's a little bump there. It's squarely in the back. So what happened was Dr. Robert McClellan, that I would invite your listeners to just Google. I mean, this guy was became one of the most renowned surgeons in Texas. Very impressive guy. He was in his 30s at this point. But keep in mind that Parkland Hospital was a hospital that specialized in trauma cases. I mean, if you're going to get shot, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better hospital to be taken to than Parkland. This is what they specialize, gunshot wounds, knife wounds. And it was a training hospital. This is where they trained physicians who would be specializing in these kind of wounds. So these guys knew exactly what they were doing. So McClellan walks into trauma room one, and there's already some physicians there that were trying to figure out what was going on. They were conducting a tracheotomy on President Kennedy's neck, where the neck wound was in the front of the neck. And that means they put a thin slice and they put a rubber tube there to enable the president to breathe, or plastic tube, not sure. So McClellan comes to the head of the gurney where the president's head was, and he sees this massive wound. And he realizes immediately this is a fatal wound. I mean, nobody can survive a wound like this. He knew this guy is, for all practical purposes, dead. And so he says to the other physicians, "Have you all seen this?" And they said, "Seen what? We just got in here a few moments before you did." And he says, "You need to come and see this." And the reason he said that is because there was no point in trying to save his life. You could not save this man's life. And so all you could do is just try to make him as comfortable as possible before he expired. Mm. So the Dallas physicians said he had this massive exercise wound. Well, they were not the only ones. The nurses said the same thing. Audrey Bell, she was one of them. Diana Boren, she was another one. Massive exercised hole. Clint Hill, who we mentioned earlier, the Secret Service agent that jumped on the back of the limousine before it headed to Parkland, he was covering President Kennedy's body all the way to Parkland. He was staring at this hole, and he later testified, this massive exit-sized hole. You've got Frank Stamps, I think his name was, or Roy Stamps. Roy Stamps was a newsman that happened to be at Parkland. He saw it. So you've got all these witnesses that established this massive hole. Now, here's another interesting aspect of this controversy. The ARRB in the 1990s, this is more than 30 years after the assassination, they discovered the existence of a woman named Sandra Spencer. Now, Sandra Spencer is a fascinating figure in this, too, because she was a Navy petty officer that worked at the laboratory that developed photographs for the military there in Washington, D.C. Very competent woman. I mean, Sandra Spencer is like A-plus when it comes to competence as a military officer. And she worked closely with the White House, mostly on the development of social photography, pictures of Kennedy playing with his children and stuff. So she tells the ARRB a remarkable story. She says that on the weekend of the assassination, she was asked to develop the official autopsy photographs on a classified basis. So she had kept her secret for 30 years. I mean, we all know what classified means. You take it to the grave with you. But the ARRB releases her from her vow of secrecy. And so they show her the official autopsy photographs in the record, which do not show an exercised hole there.
Yeah.
There's one photograph there that shows the back of the head to be fully intact. And that was the official version that came out, that there was no excised hole there, mm-hmm. that these Dallas doctors must have just imagined it. Well, she says, no, that's not the photograph that I developed on the weekend of the assassination. The photograph I developed showed a big hole there. I think it was like an inch or inch and a half. I think she had told Doug Horn in the telephone interview, 2 inches. And so she negated the validity of this autopsy photograph. So what she's doing is corroborating what the Dallas physician said 30 years before. And so that leaves us with a choice. Either all these people are speaking incorrectly or falsely, and the military photograph is genuine, or they're all speaking truthfully and correctly, and the military has conducted a fraudulent photograph here, falsely depicting the back of President Kennedy's head. And that's the choice here. Now, if you go and look at interviews that McClellan did for the rest of his life, this guy is an impressive guy. He went on, he became professor emeritus at Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, which is this renowned medical institution even today. You can find numerous interviews with McClellan saying there is no question he had that massive excised hole. Charles Crenshaw, another physician there, he wrote a book saying the same thing. So that's how we know that there's fraud in this autopsy, because all of these people are so persuasive in establishing that back of the head hole that is belied by the military's photograph.
Yes, indeed. And what she says, a blown out chunk, about 2 to 2.5 inches wide, located in about the center of the back of the president's head. And you talked about Clint Hill. So this was speaking to Arlen Specter. So I presume this was the Warren Commission. He says the right rear portion of his head was missing. It was lying in the rear of the seat of the car. His brain was exposed. I mean, did Mr. Hill's testimony there get covered in the Warren Commission report itself?
Well, no, because people really didn't pay much attention to what was going on here as these people were saying this.
Yeah.
It was just sort of, oh, well, they're just describing the wounds. They weren't seeing the significance of what was going on here, that there were two separate pictures of what was taking place, one at Parkland and one at Bethesda. Now, what was interesting is that when the Warren Commission report came out, and then the House Select Committee later in the 70s, the notion was that all the people at Bethesda said there was no massive excised hole in the back of the head. Well, as it turned out, once the documents got revealed by the ARRB, there were people at Bethesda that said he had this hole in the back of his head. And so that was a false statement that they alleged. So you actually have witnesses in both places establishing this. But the official version is with this back of the head photograph that shows the back of the head to be intact. No massive excised hole.
And referring to JFK Revisited by Oliver Stone, that documentary that was brought out a few years ago, we have a video clip of Dr. Perry, who was one of those at Parkland trying to save JFK's life. And he and Dr. Kemp Clark gave a famous press conference shortly after that. Well, there's a surviving video clip of Dr. Perry in this JFK Revisited saying that there was a large wound to JFK's head. There was a large wound to his head in the right posterior area, which is consistent with what he'd initially said about the entrance wound in the neck, that it was, you know, it looked like the bullet was coming at him, he said at this press conference. But later on, he seems to have changed his mind about that. And in JFK Revisited, it's heavily suggested that this was because of Secret Service pressure that was put upon him to change his mind. Do you have any view about that? Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that happens, because it's important that you place yourself in the shoes of these physicians at this time.
Yes.
At this point in time, there was overarching faith in the government, and the federal government. It's nothing like it is today, and has been ever since the Kennedy assassination, where people just don't trust the federal government. I mean, you have to assume they're always lying. But at this time, everybody had faith in the federal government. I mean, it was protecting us from the communist threat, and people had faith in the military and the CIA.
Yeah.
So Perry and Kemp Clark, who is, I think, head of neurology there, they have a press conference. They're both in Trauma Room 1, and they have a press conference about an hour and a half after the assassination. And Perry repeats three times that there's an entry wound in the neck, bullet-sized little hole there.
Yeah.
And it's actually being filmed, but lo and behold, they lose the film. Whoever it is who's filming, it's lost. Yeah. But somehow or another, the transcript was preserved. So that's how we know that that was their opinion, that, that the neck wound was an entry wound. Well, that night, Perry's assistant says that he came in and told her the following morning, he says, I didn't get a wink of sleep because they were calling me all night trying to pressure me into saying that that was not an entry wound. And, right. And this was some FBI agent. So by the time he's being summoned and to testify before the Warren Commission, the official version, you know, everybody's saying, oh, that the shooter's from the rear. Well, this is enormous pressure on these guys. I mean,
absolutely.
They have to be put in a position. Do I want to say that these pathologists are crooked, that military pathologists are crooked, that they've come up with a fraudulent deal here? What physician who is starting out his career wants to be put in that position? And yet that was sort of the position that they were in, because the military pathologists, they brought down a copy of the autopsy report, an FBI agent, to the Dallas physician saying, this is the official autopsy report, and this is the finding. Well, what are these Dallas doctors to do? They're not pathologists. And so the tendency would be, well, they're the pathologists, but clearly there's a disconnect here because they know what they saw.
Yeah.
So when Perry is called to testify, what's named Spector, Arlen Spector, creates this convoluted hypothetical question that is so weird that Perry says, well, yeah, I guess that is possible the way you construct the question. And then they took that to mean, oh, Perry's changing his position on it. When really, if you look at how ridiculous and convoluted the question is, he really wasn't changing anything.
Right.
But you can understand why doctors could be manipulated into changing or modifying what they said at the very night of the assassination or immediately thereafter, which I say is much more credible as to what a doctor says immediately after the event than several months later after he's being pressured to change his mind.
Yes, and we don't know what the nature of that pressure was. It might be, as you suggested, a sort of gaslighting thing going on there, or it could have been a direct threat, and that can be very powerful. I mean, it's one of the memes we have going on this podcast is, you know, the phrase, well, don't forget we know where your children are, that kind of thing. I mean, just something like that, and you know the best of us are going to change our minds.
Let me say something else, that these Dallas doctors testified that, or stated that, there was cerebellum coming out of this hole. And the reason that's so important is the cerebellum is the part of the brain that is in the lower back of the head. And so the only way that cerebellum could be leaking out is if there is a hole in the occipital region, which, as we said, is in the back of the skull.
Right.
So that's further corroborative evidence. There's also what's called a Harper fragment. And this is a fragment of bone, skull bone, that was found the day after the assassination by a medical student named Billy Harper. And lo and behold, his uncle happened to be a pathologist at Methodist Hospital in Dallas. So he takes this skull bone to his uncle, and his uncle pulls together a team of pathologists, and they study this, and they conclude that this is definitely occipital bone, which corroborates the fact that there was this hole in the back of the head in the occipital region. And so they ship the occipital bone to the Harper fragment to Washington, and where it is lost forever.
Didn't they also conclude?
They took pictures of it.
Didn't they also conclude that it wasn't occipital bone?
Absolutely.
Before losing it forever.
Oh, they had to, because they said there's no hole back there.
Yeah.
They said, oh, no, they just made a mistake. But then they lose the bone.
Right.
And
so the facts are fitted around the policy again. Yeah. So, I suppose another, this is, I'm just being facetious here, but couldn't it be possible that somebody else was walking by that day and just happened to lose the back of their head?
Anything's possible.
There's one thing I just wanted to throw in, because I think it's so priceless. Again, people will know if they've seen JFK Revisited, and that was a testimony from a friend of Dr. Perry, who we were talking about a minute ago, a certain Dr. Donald Miller, who said that he had a conversation with Perry many, many years later. Perry was always very reluctant to talk about the neck wound, but there was one case where they were just in the surgeon's lounge and it was a friendly conversation. And eventually Perry did say it was an entrance wound, unquestionably an entrance wound. He dropped his guard at that moment. So he came full circle back to what he'd originally said in the first place. So I thought that was rather nice and important to mention.
I totally agree. And Miller is comes across a very credible man.
Yes.
And you can understand why Perry would be reluctant to talk about this because of his career. He's got a family, presumably, and so forth. I mean, look what they did to Crenshaw. When Crenshaw came out with his book, they did everything they could to destroy him. Mm. Now, at this point, Crenshaw was at the end of his career, and so he didn't care. But imagine in your 30s taking on the government. They're going to come after you with everything. And so there was this huge reticence that Perry had. But then in this moment, he was good friends with this guy, with Miller, who was a physician too. They were co-physicians. He lets his guard down and says, yep, it was an entrance wound. There's no question about it.
Yeah, very revealing indeed. Okay, well, the anomalies don't stop there, do they, Jacob? Because we've got the brain exam.
I'm sorry?
The anomalies don't end there, do they?
No.
We've got the brain exam. Now, let me see, where do we go with this? Was there just one brain exam? Were there two separate brain exams? We've got a guy called John Stringer, who I believe was officially the photographer for this, and yet we've got another man, another named man, who was claimed to be... a certain Robert Knudsen was the photographer, but they weren't both the photographer. The whole thing is very confusing. Can you explain to us what went on with this supposed brain exam or brain exams?
Okay, well, if your listeners are not convinced that there were shenanigans by now, I am almost certain that they will become so convinced when they hear about the two brain examinations, because this really is dispositive. And this is when Horn set forth this part in his book. I mean, for me, it was like, this is beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a fraudulent autopsy, and therefore they carried out and orchestrated this assassination. So I come in it the back way. Instead of establishing guilt by what happened in Dealey Plaza beyond a reasonable doubt, I come at it, and this is the way Horn does too, that once you establish a fraudulent autopsy that took place after the assassination, you have established that they orchestrated and carried out the assassination. Okay. Again, because there's no innocent explanation for this. And the two brain exams, it's just dispositive of what happened here with shenanigans with this autopsy.
Okay, so this is not to do with what happened to the brain, because there's a controversy over that, isn't there? You're talking about the exam itself.
Yeah, that's really a distraction when people say, what happened to the president's brain?
Right.
That really is a distraction. It's rather irrelevant as to what happened with the brain. There's different explanations. To me, the most likely one is that it got interred with the president's body there at the funeral on Monday.
Okay.
But it's irrelevant as to what happened to it. Mm. What's relevant is that there were two separate brain exams.
Prove it.
Now, you might think, well, what's unusual about two separate brain exams?
Right.
Well, what happened was, and Horn details this again in his 5-volume book, Inside the Assassination Records Review Board. Mm. He worked under the general counsel for the ARRB, a lawyer named Jeremy Gunn. Mm. He would assist Gunn in preparation for depositions of the witnesses and research and so forth. And one day, Gunn calls Horn in and says, I want you to do a timeline on the brain exam, because the official story is there's one brain exam, which is standard. Now, the brain exam is conducted several days after the autopsy because they need to soak it in a fluid called formalin that firms it up so that they can cut it like a loaf of bread. That's what I meant earlier about dissecting, so that they can see what the trajectories of the bullets are and find bullet fragments and so forth. So it can't be done on the very night of the autopsy. Mm-hmm. So the official story is there's one brain exam, which is standard. You don't have to study the brain twice. So Gunn says to Horn, I need you to do a timeline, when it took place, who was there, et cetera. Well, Horn is meticulous. I mean, I've never met more of a perfectionist than Doug Horn, and we've become friends since then. Hmm. And so Horn takes all the evidence, does his timeline, and he comes back to Gunn's office, and he's quite concerned because he doesn't know how Horn's going to react to what he's about to say. But tells Gunn, I have concluded that there were actually two separate brain exams after studying this evidence. And he's a little nervous about this.
Yeah.
And Gunn responds, well, that was the conclusion I reached, but I wanted to see if you were going to reach the same conclusion independently.
Well, yeah.
Now, there's another thing you should know about the ARRB, that when Congress passed the JFK Records Act, They said, your job will be to secure the release of records, but you cannot investigate any aspect of the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
They actually prohibited him from doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the board of trustees for the ARRB strictly enforced this prohibition on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
So when they uncovered this thing of two brain examinations, they couldn't investigate. They couldn't recall witnesses and say, hey, we want to get to the bottom of this.
Right.
They were prohibited. Mm-hmm. So this is what happened. Stringer is the official photographer for the autopsy.
Okay.
There's no question about that. Everybody acknowledges that.
Right.
Now, you mentioned Robert Knudsen, and that's a separate matter. We'll set that aside for now because
okay.
that's another big mystery here.
Okay.
But Stringer was there at the autopsy conducting the photographs.
Mm.
A very renowned photographer, official Navy photographer, you know, big credentials. He taught medical photography there at the Bethesda Naval Medical School. So he's also summoned to take the pictures of the brain during the brain inspection, which is normal that he would be there. So he says that he was there and he took pictures of the brain, which almost certainly were of President Kennedy's brain, within just 2 or 3 days after the autopsy. And he says that Humes and Boswell were there, the three of them. And he said, I used this kind of film. I took these kind of angles of the brain and so forth. So they show him the official photographs, the ARRB does, of the brain. And he says, no, those are not the photographs I took.
Hmm.
He says, I didn't take those angles. I didn't use that kind of film. And he says, oh, at the brain exam that I took pictures of, they sectioned the brain. Like they cut it like a loaf of bread, which they're supposed to do. But the pictures that he was shown that are in the official record today show a brain that's not sectioned. It's not cut like a loaf of bread. Now, once you cut a brain like a loaf of bread, you cannot put it back together. And so this would strongly indicate that the photograph that they have of the brain is of a separate brain that doesn't belong to President Kennedy. Now, what they also figured out was that Fink said, I was at the brain exam. Now, remember, Fink was the Army colonel that Hume had summoned over. He became the third pathologist. He says, I was at the brain exam. Well, Stringer says Fink was not there at that brain exam. Fink says Stringer was not there at the brain exam. Fink says it was another photographer, an unidentified photographer. So at the second brain exam, you've got Fink, Humes, and the unidentified photographer. And that's how they figured out, Gunn and Horn, that we're dealing with two separate brain exams here. And the second brain exam cannot be President Kennedy's brain because it's not sectioned like it was at the first one. It's a damaged brain, but it's not a sectioned brain. And it's a brain that is consistent with shots having been fired from the rear, which is what the official story is. Now, where would they have gotten a substitute brain?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had a medical school there at Bethesda. They have brain specimens at medical schools. As you know, they have specimens of everything there, so medical students can practice on them.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been not difficult at all to get a second one. And finally, let me make this last point. Fink says that the brain exam took place like 6 or 7 days later, not 2 or 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So when you add all this up, Julian, you're looking at two separate brain exams.
Yes, I tend to agree. The only thing is I would say that the statements by Stringer and Fink don't seem quite as strong as you indicated. Let me just check this. So John Stringer said 2 or 3 days after the assassination, Dr. James Humes was there. Dr. J. Thornton Boswell was there. Now, he says that he's not sure about Dr. Pierre Fink. So on the phone, Horn says, was Dr. Fink present at the brain exam? Stringer says, I don't think I remember him. I'm not sure. Which highly suggests that Fink wasn't there, but it's not an absolute statement. And then with Dr. Pierre Fink, he says 5 or 6 days after the assassination, says, yes, indeed, Dr. James Humes was there, Dr. J. Thornton Boswell was there. But as regards John Stringer, I think he just says that he's... Yeah, so the Gunn asks him, do you recall whether there were any photographers present at the supplementary brain exam? And Fink says, I don't recall. So in both cases, they're not actually saying that the other was not there, but they just couldn't recall. They weren't sure.
Okay, I stand corrected.
I'm not trying to pick you up. I'm just...
No, it's good.
I couldn't find them in each case definitely saying that the other was not there. But it, I mean, it's highly suggestive because, you know, in such circumstances, you're pretty much going to remember, I think, who was there and who wasn't there. Isn't there something about the brain also being the wrong weight that you would expect it to be lighter because of the damage that it sustained, and yet it's supposedly a little bit heavier than usual?
Yeah, that's another fascinating aspect, because right. Everybody agrees that Kennedy was shot in the head. I mean, that's undisputed. There's differences as to where the bullet came in and where it exited, but there's no question that he had a huge amount of his brain blasted out by that shot. I forget exactly what the numbers are. You might have them in front of you, that the average person's brain weighs a certain amount. When they weighed this brain, and this is in the autopsy report, the official brain that was at the second brain exam, it actually weighs more than the average person's brain. And that's impossible. I mean, because everybody agrees it was like at least 20%. Some people said 30%, 40%. There is no way that it could have weighed more than the average person's fully intact brain. That's how you also know there's some shenanigans going on here.
And indeed, wasn't there also somebody who examined the photographs of this brain and said that there's an indication in the coloration of the brain that it doesn't match the timescale of what was described with that brain? Isn't there something along those lines as well?
I don't recall that.
Okay.
Very possible, but I don't recall that point. That's an interesting point.
Yeah. Oh, fair enough. There's so much information here. Can you say something about the case of Robert Knudsen? Because it was claimed obituary. I'm so sorry. Yes, a couple of obituaries in papers that he had been the photographer for the autopsy. I think he'd said in a magazine, popular photography magazine, that he was the only photographer to record the autopsy. Do we know what he photographed? Do we know what his role was in this? He seems a strange figure, really.
This is one of the most mysterious aspects of this entire case.
Right.
I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating. According to Doug Horn, the name is pronounced Knudsen.
Oh, okay.
Point that out. But that's why I'm going to pronounce it differently from that you were pronouncing it. But Knudsen was the social photographer for the White House. And this guy's reputation was impeccable. Everybody apparently loved Knudsen. He was the guy that would take the photographs of President Kennedy playing with his kids, the photographs that Saunders Spencer would then be charged with developing over at the photography lab. He worked for many presidents. I think he was working for Eisenhower, and then after Kennedy, Johnson, and then Nixon. This guy's reputation was just impeccable in his professionalism. But he was a social photographer. He wasn't like an autopsy photographer like Stringer was.
Right.
So by the time the Assassination Records Review Board is called into existence in the 1990s, Knudsen has passed away. I think he passed away in 1989 or thereabouts. But his wife was still alive and his children were still alive. And so they were interviewed by the Assassination Records Review Board. And they told this remarkable story that on the weekend of the assassination, on Friday of the assassination, Knudsen is summoned to come out to Andrews Air Force Base, presumably to help with the autopsy. And he's gone the whole weekend. And he comes back after the weekend and he tells his wife, I cannot tell you the details of what I did, but it's the hardest thing I ever did. I was the photographer for the autopsy. And it was just very, very painful because he obviously was very close to Kennedy. I mean, he had been taking all these social photographs and so forth. And he didn't give her any details. As a digression, I should mention that most everybody that was involved in the autopsy were required to sign secrecy oaths. All the people we've talked about, the helpers and so forth, they were sworn to secrecy, told this was highly classified and they could never talk about what they had seen or heard. And this is the way Knudsen was operating, that he could not detail what had happened. Well, later he was summoned to go and examine the photographs of the autopsy. I forget when that was, but I think it was during the House Select Committee on Assassinations thereabouts in the 1970s that had reopened the investigation into the Kennedy assassination. And after he did that, he came home and he told his wife, according to his wife, he says, I want you to know something. I can't go into details, but there are shenanigans going on with these photographs and this autopsy. And I want you to know that if this ever blows up, I was not part of it. Because he was very concerned that his wife and kids might think that he was involved in some shenanigans here. But he clearly said there were shenanigans based on the photographs that he had seen. Mm. Well, then he gives this interview, I think it was in 1977, to this popular magazine, photography magazine, National Magazine, where he says, I can't talk about the details, but I was the photographer for the autopsy. Well, if he was lying, if he was making this story up, he would have been uncovered. I mean, people would have come forward immediately saying, you're a liar. You weren't there. Stringer was the official photographer. And there's no question but that Stringer was the official photographer for the autopsy. Right. There's also no question but that Knudsen was not there during the autopsy. That's undisputed. But here's a man saying, I'm the official photographer for the autopsy.
Yeah, in the magazine, he says he was the only photographer to record the autopsy.
Yeah.
So that's very clear.
Yeah. Mm. Now, there's no possibility in any reasonable sense that he's making this up, because he would be called out on it immediately. You know, if he's making up a story like that on something this important, he would have been canned. There's no way he would have continued working there. And so then when he dies, there's obituaries in the Washington Post, New York Times that says he was the photographer for the autopsy. Now, undoubtedly, his family gave that to the newspapers. But the fact that the newspapers published it is very fascinating, because there's no question but that he was not the photographer for the autopsy. So what's going on here? Mm. Well, clearly, he is photographing some process regarding this body that he is made to believe is the autopsy.
Right.
That's either before, during that period of time of 6:35 to 8 p.m. that we talked about the body being sneaked in there. And there are clearly shenanigans taking place with the body. There's no other reason why they would bring the body in early like that. So he's either photographing parts of that process there, or I think more likely, he's making photographs of post-mortem after the autopsy photographs. Maybe after the embalming, maybe that's what he's doing. We don't really know what he was photographing that evening. All we know is that he is convinced that he was photographing the autopsy, and therefore he was photographing something, some process in here, which is, to me, so powerful evidence that there are shenanigans going on here.
Yes, it does seem to fit with what we said before. So under a doctrine of compartmentalization, he doesn't know what's happened before. He's just doing his little bit in the whole process. And as far as he's concerned, it's all legitimate and above board. But he just doesn't know what else anybody else is doing.
Exactly. He has no role in the autopsy itself. Hmm. He thinks that whatever he's doing is the autopsy. Hmm. And they lead him to believe that. And he didn't know any better. He's a social photographer. Yeah. He didn't know what an autopsy is involved in, that it takes, you know, 2 or 3 hours. And this man is clearly, his integrity is beyond reproach. And so, yeah, it's a highly compartmentalized operation taking place here. Yeah. All top secret. You see, this is the fascinating part of this thing.
Yeah.
But this was always their Achilles heel, Julian. The autopsy was always their Achilles heel, because they had to depend on people that were not part of the assassination. And what they had to hope for is that they could maintain secrecy long enough where people would lose interest. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, it was successful, because here in the 1990s, when this evidence is getting revealed, Saunders Spencer and so forth, the mainstream press is yawning. Oh, well, yeah, no big deal. But this is massive incriminating evidence. But the secrecy works for some 30 years. So by the time the stuff starts coming out, there's relative indifference on the part of the mainstream press. Like on the two brain examinations, they actually got reported by the Associated Press and by the Washington Post. It was one of the few times that the mainstream press reports this. And you can find that online, those two articles. But do you think that anybody, any investigative reporter followed up on this and said, you know, this is something really worth investigating? I'm an investigative reporter. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. The ARRB can't investigate it, but I can. And here it is in the Washington Post, the Associated Press. I'm going to follow up on this. There is no indication that any investigative reporter in the country followed up on that.
Yeah.
So that's where the secrecy was successful.
Right, indeed. And so these are links that were in your book, actually, because I've got the Kindle version of that, and it links through to these two archived articles. So yes, okay. So we've got the Washington Post, Archive photos not of JFK's brain concludes aid to review board. That's 1998. And then the other one from the Associated Press here, 1998. Newly released JFK documents raise questions about medical evidence. Very good articles. So presumably one would think that these articles have been debunked. Somebody's looked into it? No. You're saying nobody's bothered to follow up on this at all?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And they beg for that type of thing. I mean, any investigative reporter would say, I can make big headway on my career by getting to the bottom of what's going on here.
Yeah,
but no. There's no indication that any such investigation took place.
No.
And again, let me emphasize that ARRB staff could not investigate this, which is really bizarre, Julian. Mm. Why would somebody slip a provision in the law that says if you uncover a fraud, you are prohibited from investigating that fraud?
Yeah. Well, I can think of reasons why, but yes.
Well,
reasons why that suggest foul play in themselves, indeed.
Yeah, what the ARRB Board of Trustees really should have done was ask Congress for an expansion of their authority to investigate these things.
Yeah.
That's really what should have happened here.
Well, I have my doubts that they would have been given that authority. Anyway, yeah, perhaps they should have done that. I suppose the last thing I'd like to say is that you brought up the Zapruder film earlier on in the conversation, and I think a lot of people would say when you look at that film, you do in fact have evidence in front of your eyes that there couldn't have been a massive wound in the back of President Kennedy's head. We see it more towards the top and the right and the front. It's very clear. Blood comes out there. At the back, it seems to be intact. So that kind of defeats everything that you said here today. But as indeed you indicated earlier on, we do have reason to believe that the Zapruder film itself, as we've seen it, has been messed about with. Now, obviously, we can't go into that at all today. There isn't time to do that. Would you be prepared at some point to discuss that with us?
Absolutely. Would love to. Because that's really dispositive. The autopsy is dispositive on the military's role in this regime change operation. The Zapruder film is dispositive of the CIA's role in this because, as I point out in my book, the CIA, unbeknownst to anyone, except obviously the insiders, took possession of that film on the very the day after the assassination. Mm-hmm. And so I would love to discuss. That's the subject of my book, An Encounter with Evil, the Abraham Zapruder story.
Right.
And you mentioned earlier Dino Brugioni, who was a CIA official, top-notch guy. I mean, this guy is a renowned photo analyst. He participated in the Cuban Missile Crisis photographs. He worked for the CIA, and people can Google Dino Brugioni and see this guy is renowned. He played a very critical role in revealing what happened on that assassination. And people can find that interview online with Doug Horn and an author named Peter Janney. But I detail all this in my book, An Encounter with Evil, and I would love to come back and discuss it with you.
That would be wonderful. I'll get a copy of your book and look into that in more detail. But, you know, I suppose, you know, without hearing that conversation, which hopefully we will have, or looking at that information online, you could think, well, this is such a massive operation. This is such an extravagant conspiracy theory. How could they possibly have controlled so much? You know, you've got to control the autopsy. You've got to control the film. You've got to control everything, what people say. And does it not strike you on the surface that this is too difficult to believe?
No, because the fact is that the military can keep secrets, and so especially the CIA. I mean, when you read my book, An Encounter with Evil, you can see how they kept secret their control over the Zapruder film for 40 years until Brugioni finally reveals what happened. And Brugioni worked for the CIA, and I think Brugioni, by all accounts, was violating his oath to keep it secret, but he did anyway. But when you look at these secrecy oaths that they required everybody to take, it is a massive operation, but they succeeded in that secrecy. Like Sandra Spencer, she's an unwitting participant in this, developing these photographs. She keeps her secret for 30 years, not because she thinks I need to cover this up, but because that's just the culture of the military. Now we can see why they felt it imperative to put the autopsy in the hands of the military, because they can just classify everything. They can make everybody take vows of secrecy. They can threaten them with court martial with criminal prosecution, which is what they did when they made him sign these secrecy oaths.
Yeah.
So the national security establishment is accustomed to these kind of massive operations. We can compare them to like their regime change operation in Guatemala, Iran, Chile in the 70s. The first two took place before the Kennedy assassination. The assassination plots against Fidel Castro, they kept secret for many years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're able to keep secrets, but not obviously forever. A lot of that's coming out.
Mm. Yeah, so this idea, somebody would have talked. Somebody would have talked, we're told, but there are mechanisms to prevent people from talking. And even when they do talk, to make them look insane or to get them to change their story, there are all kinds of things, all kinds of pressures that can be brought to bear.
It's also worth mentioning that their cover-up is continuing. Mm. Notice how that there's still some thousands of records left that they say they can't reveal because of national security concerns. And that's just laughable.
Yeah.
I mean, the United States is going to fall into the ocean?
I can't think what that could be except to undermine people's trust in the establishment, which, well, perhaps there shouldn't be that level of trust.
No, it's ludicrous.
It is. Well, thank you ever so much, Jacob, for this second conversation. Wonderful to have this conversation with you, with all this detail, which I feel like we have just scratched the surface. There is so much more to look into, and I do recommend that people read your book, as I've said before. And if they can bring themselves to actually get hold of Doug Horne's 5-volume magnum opus, I recommend that as well, particularly with your book. I feel like there were still things that I'd like to have talked about, but it's just not possible. We've got to close any minute now. So again, thank you ever so much. And also for agreeing to speak about the Zapruder film, because that is a fascinating subject to talk about that directly connects with this. So I look forward to that conversation perhaps at some point in the new year, if that's okay with you.
That'd be great. Thank you very much. Thank your listeners. And I appreciate you having me on to discuss this. It's still an important topic.
It absolutely is. Thank you ever so much. Wonderful conversation.
You're welcome.
Show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajakov, attribution non-commercial, share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Jacob Hornberger. And I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.